Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Remarkable Women. My name is Nick Devlin, and I'm a co-founder of our company, Remarkable Women, where we bring women together who long to have a real impact in the world whilst also having joy and vitality. So one of the things that we have seen consistently working with women across the years is that they really want to make a difference. And yet they're also carrying this hidden fear, sometimes not hidden, that there's going to be a cost to relationships, cost to health, or even an impact on their wealth. And so what we really love to do is to bring women together to share their stories of their challenges and their experience that we all get to learn from each other. So we often bring women from our community and also women from outside. And I am beyond excited to introduce you to Katrina, Katrina Davis. And we were just laughing, weren't we, Katrina, as we were setting up this call, to say that one of the things that sometimes our women really struggle with is even the idea that they are remarkable. And I have no doubt whatsoever, once you listen to this podcast, that you're going to be able to see what everybody else sees, that you are indeed remarkable. So welcome, Katrina.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. So as we were just talking about before we came onto the call, it's really interesting when we bring people in for a conversation to even think about where will we start? And I'm aware of your journey. So where would be a good place, you think, for us to start on your particular journey? What comes up for you?
I guess it's that it's about, for me, about if you were to meet me now in this moment, what you wouldn't see perhaps is that journey. What you would see is not the end of the journey, because I'm still on my journey, but what you would see is someone who is happily married, 3 children, one of which is studying medicine, successful business or 2 businesses, and not see that actually behind that has been a tremendous journey, which has absolutely brought me to this point and has shaped who I am now. But without some of those challenges that I had, I wouldn't be in this position. I wouldn't be who I am and what I am creating in the world right in this moment. You know, and so for me, what I want to share is that even in our moments where it's really, really dark and we cannot see a chink of light, my experience is that absolutely there always is a chink of light, or there's always a different way. It's simply about finding it.
And I love that. I love how you've already shared that, because we often come across just the humanness, I think, of comparing our insides with somebody else's outsides, you know, and looking at other people and going, well, they look really sorted. And, you know, exactly as you say, you know, they look like they've really, really got it together. And so often what we forget is the journey that has brought any one of us to this point.
Yeah,
exactly. And I guess what I'm also minded of is even as you speak, Katrina, there's something about seeing challenges, we often call them masterclasses, these challenges through a different perspective.
Yeah.
Not as something to almost get over or get round, but learning and where it's going to take us.
Absolutely. And my experience is that each one of my masterclasses, as you put it, has been a true gift. Because without them, I wouldn't be who I am now. Now, absolutely, in the moment, did I think they were a gift? Would I have chosen not to have had them? Absolutely, 100%. And yet, without each of my masterclasses, and there were a few, I wouldn't be where I am today. You know, and so I guess that's what I'm really clear about is that someone looking at me would see, it's that comparison piece, looking at me, and I've done it myself. I look at other people, oh, she's got it made, or if I just do this, when I get to that point, then I'll have arrived, then it'll be great, or if I have what she has. And you don't see that journey, you don't see the experiences that have shaped who that person is, because we just see the veneer. We see the shiny, you know, made up face, you know, or how it appears to be, because that's how often, when we're not being our true authentic selves, that's how we want to be perceived. And I guess it's in the doing of that, we do a disservice to people because they don't actually see our full authentic selves.
And so what I want to say already to you, Katrina, is I really want to thank you for coming onto the podcast and having this conversation with me, because I'm minded that often when people talk about their stories, there's an element of editing out some of those darker moments, as you might describe them. I know one of the things that we've talked about in this conversation is the real authenticity of saying, you know, I'm willing to share all of it in service of somebody else being able to see a light that currently they may not be able to see. Yep. So let's just share with the people who are listening then. If we go back into your backstory, your journey, as we might put it, into some of your masterclasses, where would be a place where you would want to start to say, and even now I can see that differently. It wasn't like that then, but I can see that differently.
I think for me, my first real masterclass, as I would see it now as an adult, would be an experience when I was at university. So I had, there were challenges for me when I was growing up. There were some tricky times, but for me, that an experience that I had in university, which has helped shape who I am now, was that in my third year of university, I'd broken up.
It's in Dundee, right?
Yeah, in Dundee. So I'd broken up recently with a long-term boyfriend, and was partying too hard, and began to slip back in my studies, and for the first time in my life, experienced a challenge with my mental health. So I was eventually diagnosed with...
What age were you then, Katrina?
I would have been 20. And I think the thing that was, going back to that, the veneer, that as I was talking about before, all of that time, I was busy trying to put on a face, you know, trying to put on this, I'm doing okay, I'm having a great time. Because of course, when you're at university, that's the story. You know, your university year, best years of your life, partying all the time, having a great time. And yet during that time, that wasn't my experience. I was extremely isolated, extremely, extremely sad. You know, it was a desperate time.
Was that your first time away from home?
Yeah. Mm. And what I see now is, as I isolated myself because of the shame of what I was feeling, because I didn't understand it. And so shame kept me. The shame of feeling so at odds with how I thought I ought to be feeling meant that I didn't share initially or to begin with the people who were closest to me. And it was only when it became a real crisis that actually folks then began to know.
It's such a common thing, that isn't it? That idea that in times of darkness, as you've described it, or shame or guilt, this idea that rather than speaking it out, we actually retreat. Rather than leaning in, we lean out.
Yeah.
this idea that I can't, even showing up with it and talking about it feels too big a stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it, and it was that bit of it, it, the perception was I was meant to be enjoying myself. I was meant to be having a great time. And so every day, you know, that was my experience of trying to pretend that I was having a great time. And even now there's certain, I was really into dance music then, and this was back in the 90s. And so there's certain dance tunes that are like, they're like a sad ballad to me. Mm. Really up-tempo music, really fun, but it reminds me of a time of dancing on a dance floor, appearing like I'm having the time of my life, and yet desperately sad, desperately wounded, hurt, you know?
Music's really powerful like that. It can take you somewhere, right? It's like, yeah, a smell of music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there's...
I'm minded in that time, I'm guessing you still had lots of people around you that you could have reached out to.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I did in the end, but what I know now is I ought to have done that earlier, you know? And the only thing that stopped me was me. Mm-hmm. The only person, the only barrier that was in my way for me to begin to see that it could be different was myself. It's that thing of it, you need to get out of your own way, you know?
Voice in our head. Danielle and I often, my business partner often talk about, you're only ever 6 inches away from the life that you truly want. The 6 inches being, you know, the width of our heads. This voice in our head is so compelling.
Yeah. And so it's that dichotomy. You know, I really, really wanted to be this person who was having the time of their life at university, and searching for ways to be that person. And yet I was the person that was stopping me become that person, you know? And so that was my first lesson, I think, in that there has to be a different way, because of course then I was diagnosed, I was put on antidepressants, and so, you know, saw a psychiatrist, and so began a kind of a trajectory of, well, this is the way it has to be. And I guess I'm very closely followed. My next masterclass then happened. So a year later, 6 weeks before I sat my finals, I found out I was pregnant.
Wow.
And yeah, that was a huge...
I'm imagining that didn't help with the study.
No, not at all. And again, that was a huge masterclass, which in that moment of finding out, and even in the finding out was trying to find a different way, because it came at a time where, and I can't really remember now, but for some reason I didn't have money, or I'd ran out of money, and
I'm not sure you need a reason for that when you're a student at university.
Yeah, though that was part of my story of not being the greatest financial manager during that time. It goes along with partying too hard. And now I can see it because of a lot of the healing work that I've done. But I had to sell CDs. There used to be like shops you could go and sell your CDs back in the day, to buy a pregnancy test, you know, like, wow. You know, so, and that's what I mean. You're looking at me now in a nice big house, you know, relative wealth. I'm not that I'm a millionaire, but you know, but it's, you would think it was unthinkable that would be part of my story. And yeah, it absolutely was.
And I just want to take a moment, even just to honour that experience, you know, when it's easy to hear that as a story, mm-hmm. as you say, set in the context of where you sit in your life right now. And yet what I hear I can tap into is, you know, a woman who, 20, 21, mm-hmm. battling with depression, already on antidepressants, finding out, you know, that she in effect was a pregnant single parent, and not even having the support mechanism or the money to be able to validate that through a test. I mean, that's big stuff. I can imagine people listening to that and going, wow, you know, that's like all the lights off under the duvet. Where is light in those kind of scenarios? You know, that's a tough call.
Yeah. And it is about in the looking of back of it, is just how resourceful I was. You know, it didn't feel like that at the time. It absolutely
How did it feel?
It felt desperate. You know, literally. Yeah, it just, the hollowness of it, the desperation, and the not knowing of what decision to make, because right at that point, everybody telling me, you cannot have this baby, you know, you'll ruin your life, you cannot have this baby. And yet, absolutely, that it didn't make sense to have a baby at 21, not one bit. And yet, there was something inside of me that I always think it was Rudy, my son, who I then had, it was his life force that was just, no, we'll do this. That made it, I absolutely had to have him.
And I love that. I love how so often as women, there is this sense of the right thing to do. Mm. You know, we canvass opinions, we ask for help. And so we layer in more and more information or knowledge. And yet there's, as you say, there's like a growing knowingness, a wisdom that says, despite that, I know that this is the way. Mm. And it's a powerful thing to be able to tap into that, because I love the word you described, a life force that says, we are doing this.
Mm. Yeah. And I had no way of knowing in that moment of how that would play out. Mm-hmm.
For sure.
I had no way of knowing. And yet I knew that that was the road that I had to take. So I knew that it was going to be a difficult road. And that moment, I didn't actually know how difficult a road it was going to be.
And even that's lovely, isn't it? I think so often people look at the not knowing as if that's a problem. Mm. And yet, certainly for example, in my own life, sometimes I've been glad that I haven't known, because if I had known what was coming, maybe would have been like, oh my goodness, like, how is this even going to be possible? So even not knowing in itself can be a gift.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I can honestly say that I've never ever regretted that decision. Despite the challenges that it brought, I've never ever regretted that decision. Because it's been my biggest masterclass. Mm-hmm. It has been the thing which has brought me shades of darkness, but also such intense light.
And that, I think, let's just explain that for those people who perhaps aren't familiar with that term, masterclass. We use masterclass to describe a life event that happens that normally you wouldn't have chosen. You wouldn't have chosen the flavor, the timing, the intensity of it. And yet what we can see is, if we're able to really choose to lean into it and think, actually, what can I learn from this? There are incredible insights. We often talk about it can be a gift, which is like gold wrapped in poop. But actually, if we can look for the insights, I love how even in this conversation, we're able to see that without that masterclass, without that challenge, without that experience, the next stage couldn't have unfolded in the way it did.
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, it has shaped who I am today in such a positive way. But did it feel like that in various points throughout that time? Absolutely not. It felt bloody awful, you know, at times, but yet.
And I'm guessing, actually, Katrina, let me just ask you this. I'm guessing in the haze of all that, possibly you didn't even see just how resourceful a woman you already were.
Absolutely not. You know, because my story was I was failing.
Yeah.
My story was, you know, here I was, I'd went to university, and then, you know, I had mental health issues, then I was pregnant. It was, you know, having to buy a pregnancy test for money that I'd got from selling seed. You know, this is car crash TV. You know, it sounds like an awful movie. And yet that was my early years, you know. And now looking back, I can see that absolutely I was resourceful. And it's a reminder to me now that there's times where I don't see the resources that I have now even because I didn't see them back then. And so it's a reminder that when, you know, when there are tough times that I am resourceful. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me a long time to be able to even recognize that, you know, that I look for what might be the different way. And then, as you always say, it's about taking that first step because we can never know. And just as you said, often it's really helpful for us not to know, because if we knew, we might not take that first step, you know?
And certainly I'm aware in what you've shared with me before about that new being coming into your life. Even the journey with Rory has had its moments.
Absolutely. So there was a couple of things in terms of Rory in of himself, when he was five. So Rory was a really challenging child. Of course, I was a young mum. I was on my own. I had to move back to my hometown, and was living with my parents, which wasn't an easy relationship back then.
Maybe with parents can be a masterclass in itself, right?
Absolutely. And in that moment back then, particularly my parents, I'm sure I wasn't an easy person to live with either. And so Rory was a very active little boy. And of course, I'd never been a parent. And being a parent is a masterclass in of itself. Being a parent without a huge amount of support is another level of a masterclass. And yeah, there were people around me, but again, just in the same way as I'd done when I was had depression, I was reluctant to ask for help because I felt like I ought to know how to parent. And so I didn't ask for the help that I required.
It doesn't come with a handbook, right?
No. And I was really struggling. But if you met me then, you wouldn't have known that. Because what you'd have seen was I'd gone back to study my master's. When Rory was two, I began my career. I was working full time, really dedicated to what I did. But yeah, I was absolutely struggling. Struggling in my role as a parent, because as I later found out, when Rory was five, Rory had ADHD and quite severe ADHD. So all the things that I would try and put in place as a parent just simply didn't work with him.
And for those people who don't know what that stands for, could you just explain a little bit about what that is?
So that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Mm-hmm. So what that looks like is they find it really hard to put their attention to anything. So they kind of jump from one thing to the next. They are, particularly as small children, are very hyperactive. So absolutely, most toddlers are kind of have a level of energy, but it's to a different layer. When a child has hyperactivity, literally from morning to night, it was constant movement, never stopping. And they have no they have no sense of boundaries, so they can make themselves in unsafe positions. So as a parent, that means you're constantly on hyper alert, watching them, you know, crossing the roads, anything at all like that was just like navigating a minefield with Rudy.
And I'm guessing that would have been tricky at school.
Yeah, absolutely. So when Rudy, after Rudy was first diagnosed, and that was a massive, that diagnosis was a massive slap in the face, rather than now where I might have seen, okay, now I understand. Back then, even although I now logically know it wasn't, back then I felt it was, there was something that I hadn't done that had created it, that it was my fault.
Back to shame and guilt.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Tremendous shame and guilt that if I hadn't been a single parent, or if I hadn't, you know, that I hadn't parented him correctly, that this would be different. And of course, Rudy's now 22, so even the understanding back then around ADHD wasn't as advanced as it was now. So in school, that meant that even although Rudy was a bright boy, he would often spend more time outside the classroom than he did in it. I then went on to full warrior mode. I battled with the school. I battled with the authorities, trying to get him the education that he needed. And at the same time, still having this belief that in some way or shape or form that I was to blame in some ways. And of course, when you have that belief, that then shapes who you're being in that moment. And I have no doubt that that having that belief also meant that in some of those meetings, that there would have been a more productive way to have gone about those meetings, rather than being in warrior mode or being on the defensive. And equally, I also kind of know that I was put in a place of to feel shame. I was a single parent working full time, and all of that society puts on, puts on that, you know. And so really was put on medication. I was this was how it was going to be, that, you know, he needed one-to-one support within school. And of course, the type of person I am, I began to research it.
There goes the resources.
Yep. And again, that inner knowing that I know now, but back then I didn't see it as that. But just that there has to be a different way, that this can't be it, because I was reading up that Rudy, you know, Rudy was unlikely to finish high school, never mind do anything else. And yet I knew that he was a really bright boy, and such a lovable boy, and yet would drive me to distraction too. I mean, the patience I have now is absolutely because of Rudy. Without him, I would be a much more impatient person. Another one of my masterclasses. And so I began to do lots of research. I was researching into alternative therapies, into diet, different ways that might be to support Rudy to be the person who he wanted to be. And from a very early age, from about the age of 8, Rudy would say to people, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And Rudy would always say, I want to be a doctor.
Wow.
And to think, my God, you've got as much chance of being a doctor as you have flying to the moon. And truly believe in that, because I just wanted him to have a day in school where he didn't get chucked out of class, you know.
And isn't that amazing though, this idea that as children, you know, we know that they have infinite potential, you know, a wee boy inside all of those struggles himself going, yeah, but you know what, this is what I want. And everybody else, I'm guessing, would have labeled that as impossible, even yourself. Mm-hmm. And yet this wee boy going, but that's what I want. And I can already feel, Katrina, as you're speaking, this maybe dichotomy of, on the surface, how exactly as you say, I just want you to be able to get through a day at school, and yet a burning desire to unleash whatever that potential was in your son.
Yeah. And the other thing is that in that journey, I had no way of knowing of what the results it would create. So it was, I tried things out, partly because of that innate belief that there had to be a different way, you know, and I wanted it to be different for him and also for me, because in the making it different for him would then make it easier for me as a parent.
And I love even that, you know, that idea. And again, just for anybody that's listening to this, one of the things that we often teach is the idea of seeing life as a series of experiments, that there isn't just one way, exactly as you're saying, but there's a series of experiments, and you pick one up and you trial it. And at the end of that experiment, something truly remarkable that you might never even have thought could be possible could come out as insights. And you might even declare it as a failure, as an experiment, but then you know it's not that way, and therefore we can try something else.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, I was doing all of that experimenting, as you call it, against all mainstream medicine, mainstream educational theory. And at that point, I was working in education. Mm-hmm. I found an alternative therapy called Revive, which really, really helped Ruri tremendously. Mm-hmm. They absolutely poo-pooed it. No, it won't help him at all. You know, other things, homeopathy, no, absolutely. There's no evidence base. You're wasting your time and your money. Mm-hmm. And yet my experience was different.
And so, I love that, Katrina. I love even that idea that what may work for one person won't work for another. What might work for the masses maybe won't work. And yet equally, again, what I'm hearing with you was, even if it only works for one, and that one is my son, it's worth exploring.
Exactly that. You know, because it is that bit of having, you know, of taking that step and releasing the want of knowing of what would then be, what the result of that would be. Mm-hmm. And that was hard, because I was somebody who liked to be in control. I was somebody who...
I love how you're putting that in the past. I used to be a woman who liked to be in control.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, control was my middle name. Mm-hmm. And like I say, your masterclasses are your greatest gift. Mm-hmm. And so now I absolutely see that for someone who has control as her middle name, to be given a child who was often uncontrollable was my gift.
Yeah.
A bloody hard gift at times, but was my gift.
A gift wrapped in poop.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so began a journey with Ruri that for during his primary years it's not like I did one thing and then it was a fairy tale and everything was wonderful. It was trying a number of different things and then finding out that it made a difference. And then, so what else does he need? And that meant sacrifices. You know, I was a single parent. I didn't have a huge paying job, but I did it because I wasn't ready to let go. I wasn't ready to accept of how Ruri's psychiatrist said, this is how it's going to be. It's that back to that innate belief that it had to be different. So.
And I love that as well. There's that idea as well that once we're really clear about what our why is, why am I doing this? Mm. Actually, we can bring a different level of energy, focus, magic even actually to the world. Because when we understand, but I understand my why am I chasing after this? What can look like a really bonkers journey or a futile journey to others, to you feels like, well, of course I'm going to do this. And it's so clear that you could see what your why is. I'm not willing to write off a child at five.
Mm.
I'm not willing to write off a journey for my child ending, even potentially ending at high school. My why is I'm making a stand for this child potentially even exploring the possibility of becoming a doctor.
And do you, even although my why at that point was to find a different way, my goal wasn't actually for him to be a doctor. My goal literally was for him to, you know, back then I'd been delighted if he went to, you know, if he got through school, he got through high school and got some exam results. That would have been, had a job, end off. That would have been my goal. And so it is that bit that we take one step and we have no way of knowing, or I guess you throw a stone in the pond, you have no way of knowing of where the ripples are going to take you. And yet so often, and myself included, we stop ourselves dropping that stone because we our want or our need to know where will the ripples take us, you know? And so with Rory, I then got him additional tuition, and he began to really flourish, and he began to flourish because of his passion was learning about the body. As a young child, his greatest passion was learning about the body. And so I would feed that passion. We would go to the Edinburgh Science Festival every year. You know, we would read up on books about anything which fed that passion of finding out about the human body. And by the time he got to high school, he was much more settled. He Revive was really paying off, and he began to progress in terms of his education and kind of claw back some of the stuff that he had lost. And when he got into high school, he began to be able to focus in on the areas that really were his passion. You know, sitting in English, his handwriting is still appalling. But that's
okay. He's a doctor and handwriting.
He's not a doctor yet.
Not yet.
It's about that funneling, and it is a reminder. It's even a reminder for me in this moment of when you really have a focus and you know what your passion is, anything is possible. Mm-hmm. Anything is possible. And that's why Rory is my greatest teacher, because he taught me that from the age of eight, he wanted to be a doctor. And in that moment, it was bonkers. It was inconceivable that would be possible. And yet he had that belief that that's what he wanted to do. And absolutely, I nourished and found ways to try and support that. But it was his inner belief and my inner belief of to find that different way that it meant that he went to Edinburgh to study neuroscience at Edinburgh Uni, and now is in his first year studying medicine at Dundee. And I
want to just give a woo-woo there for you and Rory, because that, I mean, is just incredible.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even now I still get emotional when I talk about it, because recently I saw one of his teachers from primary school who asked me how Rory was doing. And in the way in which she asked me, I could tell she expected me to tell him that he was working whether he had a job even, never mind anything else. And the look of shock and disbelief on her face when I said, well, Rory's in his first year at Dundee Uni studying medicine. You'll remember he always wanted to be a doctor.
Boom. That's like a drop the mic moment, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, So yeah, and even in for myself and sharing the story again, it is that if you really live your passion, anything is possible. And yet myself included, because we so often want safety, security, we want to know, we have to know, we don't take that leap of faith. We don't take the first step to what, to who we might become, you know? And so it's the same for me, you know, part of that masterclass led me to, I worked in public service all my life. I come from a background of people who work in public service, and safety and security is huge. And you'll remember, as my coach back then, of me saying to you right at the very start, let's be quite clear, I am never leaving my job.
I do remember that moment.
Never leaving my job.
But we always love clients who come to us with this, right? Just to be really clear, these are the constraints that we're putting in right from the beginning. So
far. Yeah. And so what Rudy taught me is that live your passion, you know? And I realized over a period of time that I wasn't walking the walk anymore, you know? And so it was a huge, massive leap of faith. It went against everything that I had ever thought of, to leave my secure job and only work on my business. And it was a massive leap of faith, which even now is still a leap of faith. But for me, the key, what keeps me going and what my driver is absolutely that knowledge that if you really live your passion, really have that at the heart of all that you do, then yeah, you cannot know where you're going to be next year, in 6 months. But what you can do absolutely is take a step to where it is that you want to be.
I'm minded in this moment, Katrina. It's interesting, you know, when you think about, and it's so clear for anybody who's going to be able to watch you, and probably even if they're just hearing you on the actual podcast, when you talk about your passion and your purpose, you know, probably one thing people don't know about you is that you are a mediator. And so maybe in the time that we've got left, it might be interesting just to share with the listeners as well, how even that masterclass has led you to having this passion in the business that you've got today.
Absolutely. So it goes back to Rudy. So Rudy's father and I ended up in a court battle for around 4 years around maintenance. And that doesn't tell the story of the pain and suffering of those 4 years, because it was solicitors' letters, reactionary, ramping up the response. And, you know, you get one solicitor's letter, you respond to that letter. And so the conflict escalates, and it escalates beyond a point at which really you have no control over, because then the courts take over. And what it does is that it pitches people against people. And it pitched Rudy's dad and I against each other in a way in which we wouldn't have chosen at the outset. And
it's almost like the relationship, the humanness gets edited out, designed out of the system, right? It's two people going into battle.
Absolutely. And that's what it is. It becomes a battle. Mm-hmm. And there are winners and there are losers. And ultimately, my experience is that there are no winners and losers, because there is only a lose-lose situation. Because even if you are the winner, even if the court finds in your favour, then you're not, you haven't won, because of the damage that the court battle has led you to. So a number of years later, I was looking at different options within my career. I'd had my second child. I was now married, happily married, and an opportunity came up to train as a family mediator. And so I applied and I was successful, and I trained as a family mediator, and so began my passion. My passion and my passion based on that experience. Because often people, when I'm mediating, I think, see me and think I must be some kind of calm, conflict-free individual. And absolutely, that's not the case. You know, the reason why I'm an amazing mediator is because I've walked their shoes, you know, and that, back in the day when I was in battle with education authorities in a school, you know, all of that conflict, and even conflict that then experienced when I was working in the NHS, has meant that I have such insight and empathy for anyone who's in any form of conflict, whether that's in the workplace, and I, you know, because I'm a workplace mediator as well as a family mediator, because I have been on that journey. And without that, I truly believe that I wouldn't be as good a mediator as I am now.
And I love that. I love that idea that every step that you have taken has literally meant you've got so much evidence and experience to draw on, whether that would, you know, be with parents, with son, with education, with work, you know, even inner conflict. Yeah. It's like every single aspect of the jigsaw has got your fingertips on, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and it, and so it is, all of those masterclasses, had you asked me in that time, you know, would I prefer to have been to have done it a different way? Absolutely, I would have done. And yet now I don't regret a single one, not a single one, because they have shaped who I am becoming. Because I've not arrived yet, but they have shaped who I am, and I'm tremendously grateful to each and every single one of them, because it has created a wealth of wisdom and a wealth of experience in which to draw upon. So my ability to empathize with the clients that I see is significantly broader had I not had any of that experience.
Yeah, and I want to say this to you, Katrina, it actually strikes me that it puts you in a really unique position to be able to do what it is you do. I mean, you and I have spoken before around, you know, often when people come to a profession, they're very much interested in, but, you know, what qualifications do I need to have? And one of the things I've often said to people, you know, is that you can meet people with more letters after their name than in it and still know inherently that actually they're not qualified. Mm-hmm. There's a life experience piece which is missing beyond what a certificate has been able to gift them. And I think what's so incredible about your story is it's almost like the whole of your life, and let's hope for many, many years ahead, it has given you that qualification, that right, that expertise to be able to be in people's lives in at a time when often people must come to you and feel, like I said earlier, as if all the lights have gone off, that they are in battle, that there isn't any other way. Mm-hmm. And so to have someone who's able to say, you know what, I know that there is another way.
Yeah.
I know that there even must be a different way, I think is a huge, huge gift.
Yeah, and absolutely that, because when I see clients, that passion burns bright. My passion is for their lives to be different, for them not to end up in court, for them not to end up at the end of some horrific workplace procedure, you know, whether it's a grievance or whether it's a bullying and harassment claim, because of the damage that experience will cause them, you know. And I know firsthand what that feels like. And so that drive is absolutely to show them that there is a different way. It's just about finding out, hey, it's just about finding out where, it's about finding out, hey, you know, what might be the first step. And I often say that to clients, well, what would be the first step? You know, because often we want to have the whole case resolved, mm-hmm. Or people want to be proved right, you know, but actually what if there wasn't actually a right or wrong? What if there were just different shades of truth, you know?
And a willingness, I'm also hearing, a willingness to explore.
Yeah, exactly that, you know, because if you take the first step, then and then make a decision from there about what the next step might be. You know, we don't, it doesn't need to, you know, it's about going back to that bit about trying things out. You know, you don't need to know, or I suppose it's if you let go of the need of wanting to know where it will take you, you know.
And I have to say, I want to share this with everybody who is listening, the joy that I experience from Katrina, who used to have control as her middle name, you know, really owning two things, actually, the new knowing of letting go, letting go of needing to know. And secondly, just as we wrap up here, Katrina, I just want you to be able to see that even in this conversation, you have owned that you are indeed an amazing mediator. An amazing mediator. It's such a gift to the world to have somebody who's able to own that from a place not of ego, but from I know what I'm doing in this space, and I'm a safe pair of hands, and I can guide and lead others.
Absolutely, yeah,
it's incredible. Yeah. And so, is there one thing that you want to leave anybody that's listening who can, as you say, they can see as you are today, but have that you want to make sure that they've taken from this conversation?
There's a couple of things. One is honesty. You know, when we're our true authentic selves, or as authentic as we can be, then the facade isn't there. You know, and my experience absolutely is that the more I am my authentic self, then the more I attract people to me. You know, because we can all see when someone's playing a part, you know. And so, yeah, so absolutely my wish is for more and more of us to be honest about when we are struggling, to reach out for help, because there always is somebody who's willing to help, but we need to allow them in to help us in the first place. And that's a reminder for me too.
Always.
And I guess the other bit is my mantra that there has to be a different way, because there always is. It's about finding out what that different way might be and letting go of the need to know of how that's going to play out. And that's hard, you know, and I don't make light of it. But when we let go of that, and are willing to look at what might be a different way, then it can bring us to places that are truly unimaginable. An example, I recently drove to Dundee for a piece of workplace mediation, and it struck me as I came into Dundee of how far I'd travelled, because that young girl back there selling CDs, we could have not imagined that I was travelling to Dundee to do a piece of work for, you know, for a good sum of money. It would be unimaginable to me at that point. So my invitation to everyone is to listen to your inner knowing and trust that there is always a different way, even in the darkest moments, and know that those dark moments will shape who you are becoming.
Wow. Well, I've got goosebumps. I've also got tears in my eyes. So thank you, Katrina, for sharing this incredible story with us and your wisdom. How can people find you if they want to come talk to you about mediation?
They can find me through, it's the longest website name in the world, so they can find me through my company, which is Resolution Mediation Scotland.
Brilliant. Well, thank you. And wow, this is one of those that I for sure am definitely going to want to listen back to. So thank you once again. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.